Hi, and welcome to the Chris Business Hour. From the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater, and today we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with this week's Hartford Business Journal, our first article is written by Michael Puffer. It's titled, Prominent Cheshire Retail and Office Complex Sell for $4.5 Million. Hamden-based real estate investor Joseph Maruzzi recently sold a prominent retail and office complex in the center of Cheshire for $4.5 million to a limited liability company headed by an area welding company executive. The Watch Factory complex at 98 Elm Street includes four handsome brick buildings totaling 42,392 square feet, 11,084 of which is below grade. The buildings sit on little more than 4 acres and were completed between 1940 and 1988, according to town assessing records. Maruzzi's limited liability company sold the Watch Factory complex to 98 Elm LLC through a deed recorded May 6th. The buyer's principal is Darius Kania, who is also vice president of Lynn Welding, a Newington-based manufacturing company focused on the defense and aerospace sectors. The deal included a $2.9 million mortgage taken by 98 Elm LLC from Maruzzi's company, CJC Enterprises LLC, using First American Exchange Company LLC as a qualified intermediary. That mortgage was also recorded on May 6th. Next up, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini titled, Two New Haven Technology Research Companies Launch in New Haven. Carolyn Technologies, a developer of advanced technologies for both commercial and government applications, has expanded operations in Connecticut with two new subsidiaries in the New Haven area. Company, city, and state officials recently held a ribbon cutting at the company's Connecticut Research Center on James Street to mark the launch of ReflectTech Incorporated and Otena Technologies Incorporated in New Haven. Both companies said they are developing communications and imaging technologies applicable to defense and commercial markets. Connecticut was an obvious choice for expansion, bringing economic growth and jobs to the state, in one of Connecticut's fast-growing technology hubs, said Carillon CEO John Evans. Connecticut is home to some of the world's leading universities, including Yale and the University of Connecticut, Evans said, adding the New Haven area in particular offers an attractive combination of highly skilled engineering and programming talent, amenities for employees, and a supportive business environment. The companies are building new research labs and partnering with local academic institutions, creating approximately 30 new research, software development, and engineering jobs in New Haven, Evans said. ReflectTech is developing advanced, lightweight, low-cost, large area phased array antennas specifically designed for space-based communications and radar applications. Otena is creating advanced free space optical communications technologies for military and commercial applications, including artificial intelligence. ReflectTech and Otena are headquartered in Carillon's Connecticut Research Center at the District New Haven Technology and Innovation Campus. Carillon formed in 2017 and established its presence in Connecticut with a satellite office in West Hartford in 2021. The company has licenses to nearly 300 patents. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by David Krzyzewski is titled, The Hartford Announces Leadership Changes. The Hartford on Wednesday named successors for two executives who will retire at the end of the year. The Hartford-based property and casualty insurer said it has appointed Michael Fish as head of group benefits. He will succeed Jonathan Bennett, who will retire at the end of 2024 after 25 years with the company. Fish, who currently serves as chief operating officer for group benefits, will report directly to Christopher Swift, the Hartford's chairman and CEO. The company also said it has appointed H. Clay Bassett Jr. as Global Chief Underwriting Officer and Head of Reinsurance, succeeding M. Ross Fisher, who also will retire at the end of 2024 after more than two decades with the company. Bassett is currently Deputy Global Chief Underwriting Officer and Head of Navigators Reinsurance, a brand of The Hartford. He will report to Beth Costello, The Hartford's CFO. Both Fish and Bassett will complete the transition to their new roles by October 1st, the company said. Mike and Clay are a testament to the exceptional bench of leadership talent at the Hartford, Swift said, adding, promoting strong, experienced internal leaders allows us to seamlessly continue with our strategic plans and positions us well for future growth. Fish joined the Hartford in 2004 and previously served as head of group benefits product and strategy. He also led the group benefits underwriting organization and was responsible for the integration following the Hartford's 2017 acquisition of Aetna's U.S. group life and disability business. Before joining the Hartford, Fish held various leadership roles at Unum Group. Bassett joined the Hartford in May of 2019 after the company acquired the Navigators Group Incorporated, where he had served as chief underwriting officer since joining that organization in 2008. Before that, he served as chief underwriting officer for Folks America Reinsurance Company and held various underwriting management positions with Swiss Re, AIG, and National Reinsurance Corporation. Next, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini is titled, Vail Sports Club Owner Buys Middletown Site for Headquarter Sports and Commercial Complex. The owner of Vail Sports Club has purchased a Middletown property that will serve as his company's new headquarters, in addition to offering recreational areas and commercial outlets in a multi-phase expansion. Zach Ettinger, in June, bought the 17-acre property at 49 Randolph Road for $1.9 million. Ettinger established Vail Sports in 2018, and the club currently rents 40,000 square feet of indoor space at 1280 Newfield Street in Middletown and rents other sports space throughout Connecticut. The company specializes in running soccer leagues, clinics, camps, and tournaments. The newly purchased Randolph Road property contains vacant land and a 28,300-square-foot commercial building that will serve as Vail Sports Club's new headquarters, along with its indoor and outdoor recreation center with commercial space. Ettinger said his long-term vision is to run the organization out of one location and to create a larger stay-and-play destination facility in Middletown. The multi-phase master plan includes redeveloping the industrial warehouse formerly owned by the Connecticut Light and Power into a mixed-use entertainment and commercial venue with residential units above, he said. The new facility will also have two outdoor synthetic turf soccer fields with lights and a new 28,000-square-foot field house for an indoor soccer field. Phase 1 includes build-out for the commercial tenants. Phase 2 and 3 cover the new outdoor fields, and Phase 4 is the new field house. Vail and a property manager are already operating out the existing building, Ettinger said, and he has letters of intent for leases from a brewery, a gym, and a real estate broker and mortgage company, he said. He estimates an investment ranging from $7 to $11 million for the sports and commercial components of the plan. He has not yet determined a scope or cost for the residential project, he said. The property was last sold in December of 2021 for $2.1 million to 49 Randolph Road, Middletown, LLC. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Michael Puffer, is titled, "For the Third Time, Waterbury Officials in Search of Redevelopment Partner for Former Animet Factory Site." For the third time in a little more than 2 years, Waterbury officials have launched a search for a redevelopment partner for a roughly 16-acre industrial site that has already been the target of about $9 million in government-backed cleanup and repairs. On Monday, the city issued its latest request for proposals seeking a development partner for the once-bustling Animet Brass Manufacturing Plant at 698 South Main Street. Operations dwindled for years and then ceased around 2000. The industrial complex was untended, and its buildings began to crumble and become eyesores targeted by graffiti, illegal dumping, and other nuisance activity. Under former Mayor Neil O'Leary, a company created by the city bought the property for $650,000 in 2017. The city has spent millions of dollars in state brownfield funding demolishing dilapidated buildings. It spent another $2.8 million from city taxpayers to replace the roof of a roughly 190,000 square foot high bay industrial building on site seen as ripe for reuse. With extra environmental studies completed and more time for outreach, Waterbury officials say they are confident the latest search for a buyer will be successful. Officials say they've already been in contact with interested investors. "I think there is some interest out there at this point, and we will get some proposals that will be interesting," Waterbury Mayor Paul Pernarewski said, adding, "Ultimately, the goal is to get it back on the tax rolls, get it back into productive use, and get something down there with meaningful jobs. I think this time we can make it work." A search for a development partner in 2022 identified local aquaculture company Ideal Fish as the preferred buyer and tenant. The company proposed a large-scale expansion of its operations and jobs at the site, but negotiations dragged out and O'Leary called for a new search in September of 2023. The next RFP prompted responses from two industrial investment and leasing firms. Waterbury-based Cornerstone Realty, run by the prominent Albert family, proposed to partner with local plumbing supplier Torrington Supply Company in a $1.8 million purchase. Los Angeles-based Industrial Realty Group promised to build a business park and offered to pay $200,000 a year over 5 years for the property. Pernarewski turned down those offers and announced plans for a fresh search in March. At the time, Pernarewski said he felt the proposals were not equal to the amount of investment targeted at the site. Responses are due back to the city by October 8th. You're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with more after this break.
Oak Hill is Connecticut's largest private provider of services for people with disabilities. We offer a variety of programs, such as the Oak Hill Center for Relationship and Sexuality Education, or CRSE. CRSE broadens access to important sexual health information and addresses the vulnerability to sexual abuse experienced by people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We provide learning materials and professional development to individuals, families, caregivers, medical professionals, and educators. Oak Hill offers a series of workbooks that provide detailed relationship and sexual health information for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in English and Spanish. CRSC also offers virtual seminars and personalized professional development opportunities for your team. Oak Hill and CRSC, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
Welcome back to the Chris Business Hour. Getting back into this week's Hartford Business Journal, we have an article written by Skylar Fraser. It's titled, Connecticut Receives Almost $39 Million from Feds for an Electric Bus Fleet. The state has received a $38.9 million grant from the Federal Transit Administration, or FTA, to help fully convert CT Fast Track to an all-electric bus fleet, state officials said this week. The new federal money will go toward purchasing 46 battery electric buses and installing 29 new chargers for the CT Fast Track bus service, which stretches across communities including Waterbury, Cheshire, Southington, Bristol, Plainville, New Britain, Newington, West Hartford, Hartford, and Manchester via a bus-only roadway, Governor Ned Lamont's office said. The new funding makes up almost half of the $86.6 million project, with state money and other federal money also included in the total. The funding, which was awarded through the FTA's Low or No Emission Grant Program, aligns with the Lamont administration's goal to have the state's entire public transportation bus fleet converted from diesel to zero emission technologies by 2035. Per Lamont's office, 25 depot chargers will be installed at Fast Track's Hartford facility, and 4 will be installed at the CT Fast Track New Britain station, in addition to associated electrical infrastructure. Since its inception in 2015, the state said CT Fast Track's ridership has exceeded 26.5 million passenger trips. Next, an article written by Greg Bordenaro titled Non-Performing Loan Forces a Connecticut Bank to Set Aside $6.6 Million Reserve. A Connecticut-based bank said it will take a $6.6 million second quarter hit from a non-performing loan that was used to help finance a dental practice deal. Bankwell Financial Group Incorporated, parent company of New Canaan-based community bank Bankwell, disclosed in a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filing that its second quarter financial performance will be adversely impacted by $6.6 million it will set aside in reserve. The set-aside stems from an $8.7 million commercial loan the bank originated in 2022 to help finance a sponsor-owned pediatric dental practice. According to the bank, the loan was reported as non-performing as of the fourth quarter of 2023. The sponsor and seller are engaged in ongoing litigation, causing unresolved billing issues and restricted cash flows, Bankwell said of the dental practice deal that it helped finance. It did not provide any more details about the loan or the deal. Banks must set aside a reserve or loan loss provision to cover loans that have gone bad or may go bad in the future. That loan loss provision counts as an expense on a bank's income statement, meaning it has a direct impact on profitability. Bankwell Financial said it previously set aside $400,000 in reserves to cover the dental practice loan, which means its remaining exposure is $1.7 million. Bankwell, with $3.15 billion in assets, operates branches in New Canaan, Stamford, Fairfield, Westport, Darien, Norwalk, and Hamden. In the first quarter of 2024, the bank reported profits of $3.76 million, or 48 cents per share, down from $10.38 million or $1.34 per share in profits in the year-ago period. Next, an article written by Michael Puffer titled, 68-unit apartment building proposed for Hartford's West End. The former Hartford Medical Association building near Albany Avenue in Hartford's West End could soon be replaced with a 68-unit apartment building under a proposal before city officials. Engineer Gareth Wilson of Consultant BL Companies on June 17th submitted a wetlands permit to replace the Medical Association building on 3.78 acres at 230 Scarborough Street with a 25,635-square-foot apartment building with 136 parking spaces. The site does not contain wetlands, but construction would be within the 100-foot watercourses buffer of the nearby Park River. The building last sold for $425,000 to Anisha LLC, whose principal is Matthew Dean Hawbridge of West Hartford. BL prepared the development plans for Anisha LLC, according to documents submitted to the city. Attempts to reach representatives of Anisha and BL were not immediately successful. Next, from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Skylar Fraser titled, Feds Approve $2 Million for Berlin Turnpike Study. The state has secured $2 million in federal funding to study ways to make the Berlin Turnpike safer, an effort that officials say could impact residents and businesses along the 11-mile corridor that spans across several towns south of Hartford. The U.S. Department of Transportation gave the $2 million award to the Capital Region Council of Governments, or CRCOG, State Department of Transportation, CT Transit, and the towns of Berlin, Newington, and Wethersfield as part of its recent $1.8 billion round of allocations through the Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainable and Equity Grant Program. CRCOG said the grant money will go toward a comprehensive study of the Berlin Turnpike and surrounding areas to identify what needs to be done to make the thoroughfare safer and more inclusive of different means of travel such as bicycles and walking. CRCOG said the Turnpike, which is a major retail and commerce hub in the area, has been identified as a high crash corridor within the region. This area of the Turnpike stands out as one of our region's highest crash corridors, including several pedestrian fatalities in recent years. It's also an important commercial corridor with potential for more mixed-use development, CRCOG Executive Director Matt Hart said. With this funding, we'll be able to develop a comprehensive plan to make the corridor safe for all road users and to add pedestrian, bicycle, and transit infrastructure to position the corridor for future development and redevelopment opportunities. After the study, CRCOG said it hopes to receive future funding for recommended construction projects. In addition to the Berlin Turnpike study funding, Connecticut received $14 million for the MLK Corridor Equitable Mobility Enhancement Project in Norwalk and $5.7 million for Naugatuck River Greenway Trail Project in Naugatuck and Thomaston in this grant round. Next, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini titled, Former New Haven Laundry Facility Sold for the Monarch Affordable Housing Project. A former industrial laundry facility in New Haven, where an affordable complex is planned, has been sold for just under $2 million. The 40,000-square-foot building at 149 Derby Avenue was sold by 149 Derby Avenue LLC and the New Haven Group Incorporated to Avon-based Honeycomb Real Estate Partners and Monarch Apartment Homes LLC for $1.95 million in a deal recorded May 30th. Plans for the parcels at 149 and 169 Derby Avenue in the city's West River neighborhood were approved in late 2022 by the City Plan Commission. The new development, dubbed the Monarch, will have 64 affordable apartments. The site needed remediation work, and developers expected to complete the project by early 2025. The property was once home to the Monarch Cleaners, established in 1898. Then it was purchased by New England Linen in 1997, but has sat vacant the last several years. Next up from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Erica Phillips titled, Grant to Home-Based Child Care Network Expands Training Statewide. A nonprofit network supporting home-based private child care businesses in Fairfield and New Haven counties is expanding its work statewide thanks to a $250,000 grant. The quasi-public Connecticut Health and Educational Facilities Authority, which provides financial support to educational institutions and healthcare organizations, announced Wednesday it's made the award to All Our Kin, a national nonprofit that offers free business training and education support to thousands of family child care providers. All Our Kin intends to put the funds toward offering its classes in more rural and under-resourced regions of the state, including Eastern Connecticut, and helping home-based educators obtain national accreditation. Jessica Sager, chief executive of All Our Kin, said the grant will help the organization serve hundreds more educators. There are currently about 1,800 such businesses in Connecticut, each serving between 6 and 9 students, many of them infants and toddlers. Connecticut's families need quality child care. They need programs that work for their schedules and for the individual needs of their young children, Sager said, adding family child care does just that. Lawrence Davis, chair of CHEFA's grant committee, called the grant a double win for the state of Connecticut's economy. Thousands of working parents in Connecticut require child care to be able to participate in the labor force. Davis sees CHEFA's partnership with All Our Kin as fostering an environment where educators are empowered to succeed both as caregivers and business owners, he said. Expanding All Our Kin's programs ensures that the quality of child care throughout Connecticut is enhanced and educators are better equipped to manage and grow their businesses so that more families have access to this critical resource and these small business owners can thrive, he said. Still, quality child care, whether it's accessible or not, remains difficult for many families to afford. Expanding home-based child care capacity only addresses part of the problem. The legislature approved an additional $23.9 million in funding for child care this year, primarily designated for Care for Kids, a voucher program for lower-income families. That's a far cry from the estimated $150 million a Blue Ribbon panel convened by Governor Ned Lamont had called for this year in a detailed strategic plan aimed at overhauling the struggling sector. If we want to address affordability, we have to be putting money into the system to enable parents to pay, Sager said, adding, affordability can only come with state funding and support. House Speaker Matt Ritter, a Democrat from Hartford, pointed to this year's passage of House Bill 5002, which established a framework for the Early Childhood Care and Education Fund. And while the legislature did not allocate any money to the fund, state leaders and advocates say the fund's structure and function, apart from the state general fund, could attract necessary investments in the coming years. We've got a lot to do between now and January, Ritter said at a press conference with CHEFA and all our kin on Wednesday, saying, at the end of the day, next year my gut tells me when you see a biennium budget, whether it's from the governor, proposed by Republicans or Democrats, you're going to see an emphasis on child care. That point has been well made. The fact that all our kin is getting grants in furtherance of the things that we think are really important as a state legislature, I think shows we're working hand in hand, which is great, Ritter said. I'll now jump into the Thursday, July 11th New York Times, starting off with the Deal Book Business Roundup, first article in the roundup. After a bruising day, Biden faces a new test. President Biden and his allies may have thought they had stemmed a rebellion by fellow Democrats and donors after his debate debacle. But a series of interventions piled more pressure on the campaign, just as the president prepares to hold a news conference at the NATO summit on Thursday that's seen as his next big test. Some Democratic lawmakers made clear that they were not falling into line behind Biden. Representative Nancy Pelosi told MSNBC's Morning Joe on Wednesday that time is running short for the president to make a decision, remarks that stunned several White House officials, according to The Times. She said she would back whatever decision he takes, but the equivocal comments were seen as offering other Democrats space to speak up. Hours later, Peter Welch of Vermont became the first Democratic senator to call on Biden to withdraw. We cannot unsee what we saw at the debate, Welch told The Times, adding that Donald Trump's returning to power would be a catastrophe. George Clooney was even more direct. The actor, who co-hosted a $28 million fundraiser for Biden in Los Angeles last month, wrote in a Times guest essay that the president's debate performance wasn't a one-off. Clooney wrote, "It's devastating to say it, but the Joe Biden I was with 3 weeks ago at the fundraiser was not the Joe Big Effing Deal Biden of 2010. He wasn't even the Joe Biden of 2020. He was the same man we all witnessed at the debate." A person involved in planning the fundraiser told The Times that Biden had stayed at the event for 3 hours while the actor left much earlier. Yeah. It's also another blow for Jeffrey Katzenberg. Hollywood has been a respite for Biden, but donors have accused the Biden campaign co-chairman of downplaying the president's health. Katzenberg spearheaded attempts to convince Clooney to stick with Biden. Other donors expressed their doubts. Andrew Tobias, a top fundraiser and former treasurer of the Democratic National Committee, told The Times that the party should hold a mini-primary to select Biden's replacement. And the investor Whitney Tilson told the Financial Times that a Biden exit would draw attention and energy from donors who are all sitting there not giving to anybody. Some donors said they still backed Biden, including Alex Soros, son of George Soros, and James Costas, a former HBO executive who attended the Los Angeles fundraiser. Senator Chuck Schumer's view could be crucial. Given the majority leader's relationship with Wall Street, he heard plenty from angry donors over the past 2 weeks, deal book years. Schumer publicly backed Biden on Wednesday. "As I have made clear repeatedly, publicly and privately, I support President Biden," he said. After Axios reported, he had signaled to donors that he was open to a change. Biden's NATO news conference on Thursday will be a big deal. Donors told DealBook that they would be watching Biden closely as they figure out what to do next. Some U.S. allies are hedging their bets. Envoys to the summit have begun setting up meetings with Trump advisors, according to Bloomberg, reflecting growing doubts about a Biden victory in November. Now, do Trump. All right, two short articles from the What's Happening. First, NATO accuses China of enabling Russia's war against Ukraine. In a declaration approved by the 32 leaders of the alliance, the group said for the first time that Beijing was aiding the conflict by supplying weapon components and other vital military technology. NATO's declaration contained an implicit threat that China's actions would lead to blowback, perhaps starting with economic sanctions. And an influential proxy advisor changes its mind on Vista Outdoors big deal. Institutional Shareholder Services, which previously recommended that investors approve the sale of the company's ammunition business to the Czechoslovak group, said on Wednesday that they should now reject it. The unusual about-face is significant for MNC Capital, whose $3.2 billion bid for all of Vista has been rejected. Vista said on Thursday that ISS reached the wrong conclusion by relying on inaccurate claims by MNC. Shareholders are set to vote on the CSG offer on July 23rd. Next article from the Roundup, prosecutors claim a win in Archegos conviction. Now, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. That's A-R-C-H-E-G-O-S, Archegos, nah, whatever. A federal jury has found Bill Huang, the founder of Archegos Capital Management, guilty of fraud and racketeering charges tied to his investment firm's implosion, which led to billions in losses at Wall Street banks. The fallout was headline-grabbing but limited. The U.S. authorities see Huang's conviction as validation of their strategy in going after individual executives for corporate crimes. The context, Huang, a protege of the financier Julian Robertson, set up Archegos as a family office without outside investors, allowing it to trade like a hedge fund without much oversight. In March of 2021, big declines in its holdings prompted margin calls from lenders, forcing rushed selling that hit the likes of Credit Suisse, Morgan Stanley, and UBS. Prosecutors argue that Huang had lied to banks about what and how much Archegos had invested in. The firm had concentrated on a small number of risky stocks like Viacom CBS. All the information that they shared with us was made up, one former UBS executive testified at trial. Huang was convicted on 10 of 11 counts, including securities fraud, wire fraud, conspiracy, racketeering, and market manipulation. Patrick Halligan, Archegos' CFO, was also found guilty on 3 counts. Huang and Halligan lied about Archegos' positions in these companies and just about every other materially important metric investment banks would use in determining the firm's creditworthiness, Damian Williams, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, said after the verdict. The Justice Department said the outcome validated its approach to corporate crime. The department is making good on our pledge to prioritize individual accountability by prosecuting the most prolific corporate wrongdoers, whether they sit on a trading desk or occupy a corner office in the C-suite, Lisa Monaco, U.S. Deputy Attorney General, told Dealbook in a statement. Huang's lawyer said he would appeal. At trial, they argued that he had bet on companies he believed would do well and that he didn't sell, even when the market turned south. Who ever heard of a pump with no dump? Barry Burke, one of the lawyers, said. Next article in the Roundup, exclusive, seeing green in virtual ads for sports games. With live sports continuing to be a ratings winner, the investment firm Bruin Capital is betting on a specialist in putting virtual ads in game broadcasts. TGI Sport, a technology and media rights company owned by Bruin and Quadrant Private Equity, will announce on Thursday that it has agreed to buy Saponor, which uses artificial intelligence tools to put ads in live games. DealBook's Michael De La Merced is first to report. The deal is valued about 100 million euros or $108 million. What does Saponer do? Well, the company uses AI tools to insert ads in sports broadcasts that can be regionally targeted and even updated on the fly. Clients include national soccer leagues such as La Liga in Spain and the NHL, which has converted all advertising on its live broadcasts to Saponer's dynamic virtual displays. We are thrilled with TGI's acquisition of Saponer, Keith Wachtel, the NHL chief business officer, told DealBook in a statement. So why does it matter? Live sports remains a huge moneymaker, as shown by the eye-watering amounts entertainment companies are willing to pay for media rights. Consider the $76 billion television and streaming rights deal the NBA is reportedly close to securing. For broadcasters, advertising revenue is the driver of these deals, making technology like Saponer's increasingly valuable. It's the latest sign of growth at TGI. The company plans to fold Saponer, in which it was already a minority shareholder, into its technology division when the deal closes this summer. TGI has acquired three other media rights and technology companies since 2022 and has landed some prominent clients, notably Major League Soccer, which has a streaming deal with Apple TV. And next from the business roundup, inside Musk's mission to Mars. For years, Elon Musk has talked about the need to make humans a multiplanetary species. His preferred first step, colonize Mars. At SpaceX, the mission has gone into overdrive. Musk has directed employees of his rocket company to start designing the necessary ingredients for life on the red planet, the Times' Kirsten Grind reports. Our team is drawing up plans for small dome habitats, including the materials that could be used to build them. Another is working on spacesuits to combat Mars' hostile environment, while a medical team is researching whether humans can have children there. Mr. Musk has volunteered his sperm to help seed a colony, two people familiar with his comments said. The 53-year-old Musk sees urgency in the project. In 2016, he calculated it would take 40 to 100 years to build a life-sustaining colony on Mars. He has since grown more optimistic, believing that it can be done in about 20 years. The dream of Mars has influenced his terrestrial plans, Grind adds, saying Mr. Musk is so wedded to the idea of creating a civilization on Mars, he once said he plans to die there, that it has propelled nearly every business endeavor he has undertaken on Earth. His vision for Mars underlies most of the six companies that he leads or owns, each of which could potentially contribute to an extraterrestrial colony, according to the documents and the people with knowledge of the efforts. That includes the boring company tunneling below the Martian surface, acts as a test for citizen-led government, and Tesla's Cybertruck as a way to get around on the planet. Take them all and go. A caveat, NASA doesn't see humans setting foot on the red planet until the 2040s, never mind colonizing it. In other Musk news, a federal judge in California dismissed a lawsuit by former Twitter employees who said they were owed $500 million in severance after being laid off when the billionaire bought the company in 2022. You're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break.
The American School for the Deaf is committed to preparing students for successful lives in a competitive world. Their Transition Services program is tailored to meet the student's individual aspirations and post-secondary plans, whether to pursue a college degree, enter the workforce immediately, or find an alternative placement. This service offers career exploration, academic assessments, life skills, and self-advocacy training. Transition programming begins early in middle school and becomes more formal as students move through high school. For more information, visit their website at asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf, always able.
Welcome back to the Chris Business Hour from the New York Times, an article written by Jenna Smilak titled "Inflation Cooled Further in June." The Consumer Price Index climbed at a moderate pace in June compared with a year earlier and fell on a monthly basis. Welcome news for the Federal Reserve officials who are watching for further evidence that they have wrestled rapid inflation under control. Overall, inflation was 3% in June on an annual basis, down from 3.3% in May, and softer than the 3.1% that economists had forecast in a Bloomberg survey. After stripping out food and fuel prices for a sense of the underlying trend, the core price index climbed 3.3% compared to a year earlier, down from the previous report. And on a monthly basis, prices dropped 0.1%, while the core index ticked up only slightly. In all, the very cool inflation data provided clear evidence that inflation is slowing meaningfully, exactly the kind of progress that Fed officials have been hoping to see as they contemplate when to begin cutting interest rates. The central bank has held borrowing costs at 5.3% for the past year, a relatively high setting that is meant to cool the economy by weighing down demand for big purchases that require loans like houses and cars. While policymakers came into 2024 expecting to cut them several times, a spate of stubborn inflation numbers early in the year have kept them on hold. Now, evidence is mounting that inflation is truly coming under control, which could pave the way for a rate cut in the coming months. "This is the inflation report that we've been waiting for," said Neil Duda, head of economic research at Renaissance Macro, adding, "The important story for the Fed is that this is happening at a time when the unemployment rate has been going up for the last 3 months and the trade-offs are shifting." Mr. Duda said he thought that the Fed could even consider cutting rates at its meeting this month, which takes place July 30th and 31st. Investors more widely think that the central bank will lower borrowing costs at the meeting after that on September 17th and 18th. Expectations for a reduction at that meeting ticked up following the report. Thursday's inflation reading was markedly cooler than inflation's 2022 peak of 9.1%. Now that inflation has come down so much, Fed officials are focused on not overdoing their effort to cool the economy. They want to fully stamp out inflation, but they do not want to cause a recession in the process. "If we loosen policy too little or too late, we could hurt economic activity," Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, said during congressional testimony this week, adding, "If we loosen policy too much or too soon, then we could undermine the progress on inflation. So we're very much balancing those two risks, and that's really the essence of what we're thinking about these days." While Mr. Powell avoided identifying a specific month when the Fed might begin to cut interest rates during his 2 days of testimony this week, he did little to push back on growing expectations that a reduction could come in September. While the annual inflation numbers remain well above the 2% level that was normal before the pandemic and could remain sticky in the coming months per economic forecasts, that is partly for mechanical reasons. Inflation began to slow sharply around this time last year, which means that the data going forward is being compared to those more subdued year-ago readings. The so-called base effect makes it harder for the annual figures to decelerate as quickly. Given that, Fed officials are likely to pay especially close attention to what is happening with inflation on a month-to-month basis as they try to understand how trends are shaping up. Fed policymakers officially target 2% annual inflation, and they define that goal using the Personal Consumption Expenditures Inflation Measure, which is related to Thursday's Consumer Price Index, but released later in the month. The June version of that figure is set for release on July 26th, just a few days before the central bank's next meeting. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Ben Castleman titled "Housing Costs Long Stubborn Show Signs of Easing." Rents rose more slowly in June, an encouraging sign of progress in what has been one of the most stubborn and important categories in the inflation data. Overall housing costs rose 0.2% in June from the previous month and 5.2% from a year earlier. That's the slowest pace of year-over-year growth since 2022, down from a peak of more than 8% early last year. Economists, including officials at the Federal Reserve, are paying particularly close attention to housing because it is by far the largest component of the Consumer Price Index, accounting for more than a third of the overall measure. It has also been one of the most surprisingly sticky categories. Forecasters have been predicting that housing inflation would cool for more than a year now, but have been persistently disappointed. Those forecasts were based on data from private companies like Zillow and Apartment List, showing that rent growth has slowed dramatically in much of the country. Zillow's data, for example, shows that annual rent growth nationally peaked at nearly 16% in early 2022, but has now fallen to just 3.4%, slower than before the pandemic. In a few markets, such as Austin, where newly built apartments are coming on the market, rents are falling outright. The government's measure of rents tends to move more slowly than the private sector sources and is less prone to wild swings. That's partly because the private data only includes homes when they turn over to new residents. The government's data attempts to capture monthly expenses for all renters, including those who renew their leases. There are also other methodological and conceptual differences between the public and private measures. Still, economists have been surprised by how long the gap between the measures has persisted, and some forecasters began to worry that it might never fully close, that demographic forces or changes in the housing market during the pandemic could keep housing inflation higher long term. That would make it significantly harder for the Fed to bring overall inflation back to its long-run target of 2%. The data released Thursday may help ease those worries. Rents were up 5.1% from a year earlier and have risen at just a 4.1% annual rate over the past 3 months. And the government's measure of costs for homeowners, which had been particularly stubborn in recent months, rose at its slowest pace since 2021 on a monthly basis. In the confusing approach to housing inflation used by economists, homeownership costs in the Consumer Price Index are based on rents, not on the direct expenses of buying or owning a home. Greg McBride, the chief analyst at Bankrate, called the housing numbers a long-awaited easing. "Once in a row is not a streak," he wrote in a note to clients, "but more readings like this in the months ahead is consistent with getting inflation down to a 2% annual rate." Next up from the New York Times, an article written by Jack Ewing titled, "Biden offers $1.7 billion to help factories build electric vehicles." The federal government will grant car and auto parts factories in 8 states $1.7 billion to begin producing electric vehicles and other clean energy technology the Biden administration announced on Thursday. Among the 11 recipients will be a Jeep factory in Belvidere, Illinois, that the brand's parent company, Stellantis, closed last year. The money will allow the plant to reopen and produce electric vehicles, officials said, restoring almost 1,450 jobs. Other beneficiaries include a factory in Georgia that plans to make Bluebird electric school buses, a General Motors factory in Michigan that will shift production from gasoline to electric vehicles, and a Harley-Davidson factory in Pennsylvania that will increase production of electric motorcycles. The funding helps to address fears that electric vehicles will endanger jobs at factories that make gasoline-powered vehicles or parts for internal combustion engines as the industry shifts to EVs. To qualify for the money, companies had to commit to retraining their existing workers. Employees at all of the factories chosen are represented by unions. Officials said they gave priority to communities that suffered disproportionately from pollution or lack of investment. Several of the factories are in Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Georgia, states where narrow margins will determine the outcome of the presidential election. President Biden, in a statement, sought to contrast his industrial policies with those of former President Donald Trump. This delivers on my commitment to never give up on the manufacturing communities and workers that were left behind by my predecessor, Mr. Biden said. The funds will preserve 15,000 jobs and create almost 3,000 new ones, Jennifer Granholm, the energy secretary, said during a conference call with reporters on Wednesday. In a reference to China, she said the money will allow the United States to compete with other countries who were subsidizing their auto industries. The awards will draw on funds allocated by the Inflation Reduction Act passed by Democrats in Congress in 2022. The legislation provided subsidies that have fed a boom in construction of electric vehicle factories and battery plants. Some automakers, including Ford Motor and Mercedes-Benz, have recently slowed their investments in electric vehicle manufacturing because demand has not grown as fast as they had expected. But industry analysts expect sales of electric vehicles to pick up as prices fall and more chargers become available. Affordability and charging are the biggest concerns for car buyers interested in electric vehicles, surveys show. There are signs that consumer appetite for battery-powered cars is increasing. Sales of electric vehicles in the United States climbed 11.3% in the second quarter from a year earlier, Cox Automotive, which tracks the industry, said on Tuesday. Americans bought or leased more than 330,000 electric cars and light trucks during the quarter, accounting for 8% of all new cars sold or leased in the three-month period. The German automaker BMW said Wednesday it delivered 180,000 electric BMWs worldwide in the first 6 months of the year, a 34% increase from the same period a year earlier. Companies receiving the federal awards announced on Thursday will also be able to use the money to produce plug-in hybrid vehicles, which have both electric and gasoline motors, and other zero-emission technologies such as hydrogen fuel cells. Before they can receive the money, companies must negotiate agreements with the Department of Energy that will obligate them to meet investment and employment targets and to provide workers with benefits like training, childcare, and pensions. The grants are not blank checks to corporations, Julie Sue, the acting Secretary of Labor, said, adding, they should uplift entire communities and maintain high-wage jobs. The awards include a $32.6 million grant to a U.S. subsidiary of Hyundai Mobis, a Korean auto parts maker, which will convert a Toledo, Ohio plant to make chassis for plug-in hybrid vehicles and battery systems. And $500 million will go to GM, which will convert a plant in Lansing, Michigan, from producing gasoline cars to electric models. The Jeep factory in Illinois will receive $334.8 million, and another Stellantis operation, a transmission plant in Kokomo, Indiana, will get $250 million to help it make components for electric vehicles. Well, you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'm Barry Slater. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, and thank you for letting me give you the business. Have a good week.